Help DEA keep our communities safe and healthy by participating in National Prescription Drug Takeback Day, Saturday, October 25th. Take action right in your own home by cleaning out your medicine cabinet of unneeded medications. Keep them safe, clean them out, take them back. Find a collection site near you at DEATakeback.com. Do your part to lower overdose deaths and prevent prescription drug misuse before it starts. That's DEATakeback.com.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. Today we are strapping in and taking you straight to the heart of how modern stand-up comedy was professionalized, monetized, and, well, frankly, militarized sometimes.
Yeah, it's quite a story.
We're talking about one venue, the Comedy Store in West Hollywood, and the really complex figures who ran it, starting with the showman Sammy Shore, but, you know, ultimately defined by the legendary, maybe infamous, demanding gatekeeper, Mitzi Shore.
Right. And it's vital, I think, to frame this accurately for you listening.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't just another club where comedians performed. It was more like the Crucible, the College of Comedy, as she called it.
Exactly.
Our sources today, it's a powerful stack of biographical bits, historical excerpts about both Mitzi and Sammy Shore. They really force us to look beyond just the punchlines. We're going to examine the volatile economic and cultural environment that produce these global superstars.
So our mission here is to dissect the central kind of incredible paradox of this institution. How did this chaotic, high-pressure venue, which, you know, famously refused to pay its performers for years?
Yeah, that's the kicker.
How did that place become the single most important launching pad for the careers of basically every major name? We're talking Jay Leno, David Letterman, Robin Williams, Joe Rogan.
The list goes on and on.
How did a no-pay showcase become the institution that defined professional comedy? Okay, let's unpack this history.
Right. So to really get the rise of the Comedy Store, we actually have to start not with Mitzi, but with her husband at the time, Sammy Shore. He was a co-founder.
Okay.
The club opened its doors April 1972. Location, 8433 West Sunset Boulevard in West Hollywood.
A legendary address.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And Sammy opened it with Rudy DeLuca, who was a screenwriter and actor.
Yeah.
But really, it was Sammy's status as a working, pretty high-level comic himself that was the immediate draw.
But what's so fascinating to me here is that the address itself, 8433 Sunset, it already carried this immense weight of Hollywood history. It lent this strange kind of immediate, maybe borrowed glamour to this new comedy venture.
Totally. It wasn't just any storefront.
It was moving into a piece of entertainment royalty, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture of the Sunset Strip, I mean, this building had a serious reputation long before stand-up was even the main thing there.
Like what? What was there before?
Well, back in 1935, the location housed Club Seville. And Club Seville was known for this utterly opulent crystal marine room. Can you imagine this?
Go on.
A dance floor made of actual crystal. And underneath it, you could see, like, subsurface fish swimming around in fountains.
Mm-hmm.
It was the absolute definition of high-end 1930s Hollywood excess.
Oh, wow. Okay, so it was already associated with serious opulence and spectacle.
Totally. Then in 1940, it became Ciro's. And Ciro's was the quintessential Hollywood nightclub for almost two decades, running right up until 1957.
Every big star went there, presumably.
Every major movie star, every power player of the era. If you were someone, you were seen at Ciro's. Then the building transitioned, you know, in the early 1960s into Ciro's Le Disque.
Ah, the rock and roll era.
Exactly. It shifted focus to rock, became incredibly influential in its own right. That's actually where the Byrds were famously discovered in 1964.
That's amazing. So when Sammy Shore leased or bought this space in 72, he wasn't just getting a room. He was inheriting decades of legendary, like, A-list electricity.
That's a great way to put it. This wasn't some random hole in the wall. It had serious pedigree, even if he was turning it into a very different kind of venue focused on comedy.
And that pedigree sort of popped back up, didn't it? Just 2 years later in 74.
Yeah, there's this perfect anecdote. It really speaks to the continuity of Hollywood history there. The Comedy Store hosted the wedding reception for Liza Minnelli and Jack Haley Jr.
Wow. Liza Minnelli's wedding reception at the Comedy Store.
Well, sort of. And the detail that really sticks with me from the sources is that the club actually had to cover up its own Comedy Store signage for the evening.
No way.
Yeah, they put up signs that just read Ciro's, specifically to, you know, invoke the building's glamorous past and suit the occasion.
Who was there? Must have been packed with stars.
Oh, it's a total who's who event. Massive figures like Elizabeth Taylor, Johnny Carson, Bob Fosse, Cher, Sammy Davis Jr., another Sammy, and dozens more. It really cemented the club's position early on as a place where show business at its highest level still happened.
That context is so crucial because it demonstrates that Sammy Shore, you know, he wasn't some newcomer just trying to scratch out a living. He was established. He moved in those circles.
Definitely.
Let's delve into his background a bit more. Where did this professional showman come from?
Well, Sammy started his career doing stand-up with Shecky Green, actually, way back in the Catskill Mountains.
The classic Borscht Belt training ground.
Exactly. That was the traditional proving ground, especially for Jewish comedians in the, you know, 40s and 50s. And that history, I think, gave him a really deep appreciation for the craft, but also for the need for a relentless work ethic.
But his biggest professional break, the one that probably gave him the capital and the connections he needed to even think about launching a comedy store, that was tied to the king himself, right?
Precisely. His huge pivotal moment came in 1969. Sammy was chosen to open for Elvis Presley's massive comeback performance at the International Hotel in Las Vegas.
That's monumental. Elvis's return was, like, global news.
Absolutely huge. And he didn't just get a one-off gig out of it. He became a regular fixture for the king.
Right.
He kept opening for Elvis's road shows right up until 1972, which is, tellingly, the exact same year he opened the club.
Interesting timing.
Yeah. And he was a professional success story beyond Elvis, too. He opened for other massive headliners. Tony Orlando, Tony Bennett, Barbara Streisand, Sammy Davis Jr. again. He really understood the economics and the demands of being a top-tier working comic. That's important context for later when we discuss the club's philosophy.
And he wasn't just a comic. Our sources mention he had other layers, too. He served in the U.S. Navy during World War II.
Right. Brings a certain discipline, maybe.
And he later appeared in films, including some classic Mel Brooks movies like Life Stinks and History of the World Part 1.
Yeah, he was around.
So Sammy seems like the perfect guy to launch this club. Seasoned, incredibly well-connected, disciplined from his service.
He absolutely was. However, the story of a comedy store, as we really know it, the institution it became, that story truly begins the moment he steps away. Sammy might have launched the club, but it was Mitzi Shore, his wife, who became its living, breathing, and, frankly, sometimes terrifying identity.
Okay, so here's where the narrative takes a hard pivot. Sammy was the successful opener, the established name, but Mitzi-born Lillian Sadel, she became the essential gatekeeper, didn't she?
Completely, yeah. She was born in 1930 in Marinette, Wisconsin. Quite a journey from there to the Sunset Strip.
Definitely. She studied art, actually, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a field that feels, you know, worlds away from the cutthroat entertainment business.
Very different vibe. But she dropped out of university after meeting Sammy Shore, and they got married in 1950.
So they were married for quite a while.
Yeah, 24 years, raised four children together, but their divorce in 1974, which was, you know, just 2 years after the club opened, that's the absolute critical hinge point. That's what gave birth to the modern comedy store.
And the divorce settlement. This is the part that's always seemed kind of wild to me. Mitzi acquired complete, total ownership of the comedy store as part of that agreement.
That's right.
But wait, I need clarification here. So Sammy Shore, this guy opening for Elvis, presumably making good money, he valued the club so little that he basically traded it to lower his alimony payments. Was the club actually, like, losing money then, or was the valuation just low because of the no-pay model for comics?
That is the million-dollar question, isn't it? And the sources are pretty explicit on this. Sammy himself stated, this was in a 2003 interview, that he, quote, relinquished control of the club to lower his alimony payments.
Wow.
So if we look at the economics of 74, the club was still a new venture, right? Mm. Still finding its footing. And its entire structure was built around paying $0 to its main talent, the comedians.
Right. Meaning the overhead on talent was non-existent, but the potential revenue wasn't fully realized yet. So the business probably looked more like an operational headache than a guaranteed gold mine, especially compared to, you know, hard cash alimony payments he wouldn't have to make.
Precisely. Yeah. For a working comedian like Sammy, who was still touring, the stability of a lower fixed alimony payment was likely way preferable to the daily headaches and the financial uncertainty of running a brand new nightclub venture on Sunset.
It really speaks volumes about how the club was perceived in those very early days. Sammy wanted out.
He did. And Mitzi clearly saw the potential that maybe he didn't fully grasp or didn't want the hassle of realizing.
And Mitzi, right away, she proved she was a pretty shrewd operator, didn't she? She didn't have Sammy's headliner cash flow, so how did she even keep the doors open initially?
Well, the sources reveal that almost immediately after taking full control, Mitzi went straight to her network. She secured a significant cash loan from none other than comedian Shecky Green.
Sammy's old Catskills partner.
The very same. That loan was crucial to ensure operations could continue smoothly. It was a savvy move. Showed she understood the business side right away. Leverage your relationships, maintain cash flow, whatever it takes.
And she wasn't content just keeping the lights on. She expanded aggressively.
Oh, yeah. She completely transformed the venue from, you know, a modest showcase room into a comedy behemoth. In 1976, she didn't just renew the lease on the space.
She bought the whole building.
Bought the entire building and immediately started renovations, expanded that initial 99-seat theater into a massive 450-seat main room.
That's a huge leap.
Huge. This wasn't just minor structural work. This signaled her ambition loud and clear. She was creating a venue designed for profit, designed for mass consumption of comedy.
And her role was never just like manager in the back office, right? She became the arbiter of taste. She was one deciding who got stage time, who developed, who failed.
Absolutely. She was deeply involved, not just in the day-to-day management, but crucially in the recruitment and maybe most importantly, the development of talent.
Mm.
She didn't just book acts, she molded them.
And the list of names she either launched or seriously nurtured there, it's basically a who's who of American stand-up for the next 30 years.
It really is. You've got the titans of television and arena comedy.
Mm.
David Letterman, Jay Leno, Robin Williams, Jerry Seinfeld, just mass.
The edgier guys, the character comics.
Right. People like Roseanne Barr, Jim Carrey, Whoopi Goldberg, Andrew Dice Clay.
Mm-hmm.
And then even the modern generation, the podcasters who came up through her system, like Joe Rogan and Marc Maron, Gary Shandling too. Pauly Shore, her son, obviously.
It was like she created this intense environment where if you could survive Mitzi's system, her boot camp,
yeah,
you were ready for prime time anywhere in the world. But that very intensity, combined with the fact that this huge 450-seat room was now filling her pockets, that's what created the inescapable tension, isn't it? The thing that boiled over into that defining labor dispute.
Exactly. The comedians eventually realized they were building her empire night after night for free. And they decided they'd had enough. Yeah, this is the era where the club really transcends just being an entertainment venue. It becomes a pivotal piece of, believe it or not, American labor history.
And it all hinged on Mitzi's famous, or maybe infamous, College of Comedy philosophy.
That was her line, yeah.
Let's break that down a bit. She insisted the venue was purely a training ground, right?
Yeah.
A place where aspiring comics learned their craft. And the payment wasn't cash. It was exposure to casting agents, talent scouts. Stage time was the currency.
Mm-hmm.
Was this like a genuinely held artistic philosophy on her part, or was it just a really cynical business model designed to maximize her profit?
You know, I think the truth is it was probably both. And that's what makes Mitzi such a fascinating, complicated figure.
How so?
On one hand, she seemed to genuinely believe that if you got paid, you wouldn't be hungry enough. You wouldn't push yourself to innovate.
Mm.
She saw herself as running this rigorous, demanding artistic academy.
But
the business reality was just inescapable, wasn't it? It allowed her to run a major expanding nightclub on the Sunset Strip without having a payroll for her core product, the performers.
So connecting that to the bigger picture of labor, she was essentially arguing that artistic passion somehow negated the need for actual wages.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And here's the detail that really highlights the maybe the cynicism or at least the business calculation involved. Shore did pay her entire operational staff.
Right. The bartenders, the waitresses, the door guys, the coat check people, they were all getting paid.
Everyone else was on payroll. It was only the talent, the people actually generating the revenue by bringing in the crowds, who worked entirely for free, for exposure.
So the resentment must have been building for years. What was the final trigger?
It really reached a breaking point after 1976. That's when Mitzi bought the whole building and finished that big expansion to the 450-seat main room.
Oh.
The comics saw the place packed. Night after night, they saw the significant profits coming in, and they just felt, understandably, that they were being exploited. They were the engine, and they deserved a piece of the action. Their work justified payment.
So in 1979, they decided to organize.
To unionize.
Yeah. They formed this short-lived labor union called Comedians for Compensation. Their demand was simple, get paid for performing sets.
And Mitzi refused.
Flat out refused, which led directly to a bitter, pretty grueling 6-week picket line that kicked off in March 1979.
Now, this wasn't just some minor disagreement. This was an existential battle, wasn't it? It split the entire LA comedy community right down the middle, pitted friends against each other.
Oh, absolutely. Deep divisions.
Who are the major figures leading the picket line? Who was willing to risk Mitzi's wrath? Well, the leadership included some guys who would become future giants. Jay Leno was a big voice, already known for his incredible work ethic. Tom Dreesen was a really powerful organizer behind the scenes. And David Letterman, incredibly, served as the MC for the picketers, leading chants, holding rallies right outside the club.
Wow, Letterman as a picket captain.
Yeah. They were highly visible, and they were absolutely risking their careers by standing outside that club door every night.
And on the other side, who crossed the line? Because that decision, I imagine, haunted some comics for years afterwards.
It did. Comics who famously crossed the picket line included Gary Shandling and Yakov Smirnoff.
Yeah.
It highlights just how incredibly difficult that personal choice was.
Why cross?
Well, for many working comics, especially those not yet established, the Comedy Store was basically the only game in town. Their entire livelihood, their chance at getting seen, depended on staying in Mitzi's good graces. Crossing that line was seen by some as a sign of loyalty to the institution, even if it meant betraying their striking peers. Huge pressure.
And the sources are also really clear on the legal footing of this whole dispute, which is crucial for understanding why Mitzi maybe felt she had the upper hand for so long.
Yeah, what's really fascinating here, legally speaking, is that this job action, it wasn't technically considered a strike under labor law.
Why not?
Because Mitzi's business model classified all the comedians as independent contractors, not as employees under any kind of contract.
Ah, the contractor loophole.
Exactly. She didn't issue traditional paychecks or W-2s. She offered stage time and opportunity. So she could basically evade traditional labor laws because the performers were classified as freelancers, receiving a showcase opportunity rather than as workers providing a paid service.
So the Comedians for Compensation Union had a really tough legal battle.
Incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
They were fighting not just a powerful club owner, mm-hmm. but also this fundamental technicality in labor law that totally favored the owner in this specific setup.
And that 6-week picket line, it wasn't just people holding signs peacefully, was it? Things got heated. Jay Leno was famously injured.
That's right. Lena was actually hit by a car that was attempting to, like, rush through the picket line. That highlights the physical danger involved and just the raw, escalating emotion of the dispute.
Both sides felt completely justified, yeah. You imagine.
Absolutely. Mitzi felt justified in her artistic ideal of exposure and running her college. The comics felt justified in their basic economic right to be paid for work that was clearly generating huge profits for the club.
But the conflict took a truly, truly tragic turn, one that cemented the human cost of that no-pay philosophy forever. We have to pause here, I think, and talk about Steve Lebetkin.
Yes, this is the really dark moment. The turning point was tragically real. A comedian named Steve Lebetkin, who was reportedly struggling both financially and emotionally, he committed suicide. He jumped off the roof in the adjacent Continental Hyatt House.
The infamous Riot House.
The very same. Which significantly overlooked the Comedy Store.
Oh my God. That's incredibly heavy. What was the impact of his death on the ongoing dispute? Did it change things?
It had to. His suicide note was explicit. It directly cited Mitzi Shore and his inability to work at the store as contributing factors. The most heartbreaking line read, "My name is Steve Lebetkin. I used to work at the Comedy Store."
Wow.
He apparently hoped his death would serve as the ultimate resolution to the struggle. And the sources suggest this tragedy just profoundly shocked and destabilized the entire community. It forced both sides, I think, to recognize the real severity of the economic desperation that Mitzi's system could foster for struggling artists.
So did Mitzi Shore finally relent then? Did she give in after that?
She did relent, but importantly, only after she lost her competitive advantage. It wasn't purely out of sorrow or immediate legal pressure, it seems.
What do you mean?
She only folded once. Her main competitor in L.A., Bud Friedman, who owned the Improv Club, announced that he would start paying his comics.
Ah, market forces.
Exactly. Once the L.A. market standard shifted, Mitzi really had no choice if she wanted to retain any top talent. So she finally agreed to pay the comics. The amount agreed upon was $15 per set.
$15, which sounds like almost nothing today. But if we put that into economic context, what was $15 worth back in 1979?
Yeah, sounds tiny. But our sources indicate that $15 per set in 79 is roughly the equivalent of about $65 today.
Okay, so not life-changing money, but...
Not life-changing, but it was a crucial foundational step. It marked the definitive end of unpaid labor as the standard model at the store. It was symbolic and practically important.
And that settlement hammered out through this intense, sometimes tragic labor action in Los Angeles. It immediately set a new national standard, didn't it?
It absolutely did. Mm-hmm. It forced the New York City clubs, places like Catch a Rising Star, and other major comedy venues across the U.S. to start compensating their stand-up talent as well.
So this six-week standoff, born from the success and the policies of the Comedy Store, irrevocably changed the entire economic structure of professional stand-up comedy.
Yeah, it really helped turn it from what was often seen as a hobbyist's pursuit or something you did for exposure on the side into a potentially paid career path, right from the club level. A huge shift.
What's so remarkable about Missy Shore, though, is that despite her, you know, incredible stubbornness on the compensation issue, she showed surprising foresight, maybe even institutional bravery, when it came to diversity and inclusion within the club itself.
That's another layer to her complexity, absolutely. She seemed to recognize that talent wasn't monolithic, and she created these necessary institutional spaces for voices that were often routinely excluded elsewhere.
Right. The boys' club environment of professional comedy back then was notorious, wasn't it?
Oh, incredibly so. And Mitzi, perhaps recognizing that a huge pool of talent was being overlooked or maybe wasn't comfortable in the main room, deliberately broke that mold right there within her own club on the Sunset Strip.
And the most famous example of this has to be the Belly Room. Tell us about that space. Why was it so revolutionary, especially for female comics?
So Mitzi converted the upstairs section of the club into the Belly Room. This was as early as 1978, even before the strike fully resolved. It was a really tight, intimate space, only held about 50 seats. And for a significant period, Mitzi ran it with a pretty radical policy. She booked female comedians exclusively.
Exclusively women? Why was that necessary? Couldn't women just perform on the main stage downstairs?
Well, they could, and some did, but they often faced an immediate disadvantage. The sources suggest the main room, often dominated by established male comics and catering to a predominantly male audience sensibility at the time, just didn't always provide the same supportive environment, especially not for women trying to develop edgier, riskier, more personal material.
So the Belly Room was like an incubator.
Exactly. It provided this almost unheard of opportunity for female comedians to really find their voice, to bomb safely, refine their material, build a following, all without the immediate pressure and maybe judgment of the main room's expectations. It was crucial for women who would later define comedy, like Roseanne Barr and Whoopi Goldberg definitely came through there.
And her commitment to inclusion, it didn't stop with the Belly Room, right? She kept creating these specialized nights for decades.
Yeah, she did. As the club matured, Mitzi seemed to understand that variety wasn't just fair, it was good business. It kept things fresh. So in the 1990s, she created specific specialty nights dedicated to Latino performers, gay performers, lesbian performers groups that often struggled to get consistent, quality stage time in more traditional venues.
And we absolutely have to highlight Fat Tuesdays. That became legendary.
Fat Tuesdays was immense.
Yeah.
It ran for years and became this essential, foundational staple for the Black comedy scene in Los Angeles. She provided the infrastructure, the room, the staff, the promotion, the platform necessary for that community to really grow and thrive within the store.
It launched so many careers.
A whole generation of Black comics got crucial developmental stage time there that they might never have gotten otherwise. It really shows Mitzi was focused not just on who was funny right now, but who could be funny next, regardless of their background. She had an eye for raw talent.
So it's this incredible contradiction again. On one hand, she's running this tight, arguably exploited a business model that leads to a tragic strike.
Okay.
But on the other hand, she is this champion of marginalized talent, providing them with institutional support that was basically unmatched anywhere else in the industry at the time.
It's baffling and, yeah, kind of beautiful in its complexity.
And that contradiction, that mix of support and chaos, it extended directly into the living arrangements of her comics, too, didn't it? We absolutely have to talk about the most legendary, most chaotic comedy incubator maybe in history. The Crest Hill House.
Oh, the Crest Hill House, yes. The comedy frat house, as it's often called. The sheer level of talent and, frankly, debauchery that was concentrated in that one single 5,000-square-foot house. Mm. It's just staggering to think about.
So Mitzi owned this house. Where was it?
Yeah, she bought this house nearby. The address was 8420 Crest Hill Road. She actually bought it at the same time she bought the club building itself back in 1976. But it wasn't until 1979, interestingly, right around the time the strike was happening or just ending, that she essentially just gave the place over to the working comics, let them crash there, sleep there, live there, basically rent-free.
Wow. Why would she do that? Was it like an economic tool to keep them loyal and around after the strike? Or was it more a genuine attempt to foster some kind of, you know, 24/7 comedy community?
I suspect it was likely a bit of both. But primarily, I think she wanted to foster that intense, hyper-competitive, always-on atmosphere, keep the comics immersed.
And it worked.
Oh, yeah. The house became legendary for these all-night writing sessions that would immediately devolve into all-night parties. Fueled very heavily, according to our sources, by cocaine and alcohol. It was a non-stop pressure cooker designed to test and refine material, basically 247.
The list of residents, it's just astonishing. And it wasn't just the young, up-and-coming talent living there, right?
No, not at all. It attracted some of the biggest names, too, people drawn in by the creative energy, the chaos. Residents included Andrew Dice Clay, Mark Maron, Richard Pryor dropped in, Robin Williams hung out there. These were already stars, living side by side with younger comics. Bill Hicks, the iconic counterculture comic, actually moved into the house when he was just 18 years old.
I cannot even imagine the atmosphere in that house. The sources suggest it was just this environment of constant, brutal, creative competition.
It was like the ultimate unscheduled high-stakes masterclass. Jim Carrey, who stayed there for a period, is specifically noted in our sources for having, quote, turned his act around in this house.
Wow.
Imagine being surrounded constantly by those kinds of minds prior, Williams Kinison later on. Knowing your next joke, your next line, had to be killer just to earn respect at the breakfast table. You know, the chaos was maybe productive in a weird way. It forced them to be incredibly sharp.
Mitzi even tried to, like, capture some of that crazy energy on film, didn't she?
She did, yeah. Around 1987, she actually shot a 12-minute pilot presentation there, trying to somehow commercialize the wild atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, the debauchery just became unsustainable.
Too much even for Mitzi.
Apparently so. The sheer chaos, the nonstop parties, the rampant drug and alcohol consumption, it just became too much for even her to manage or condone long term. The place was reportedly falling apart.
So the architect of this incredible, chaotic college of comedy finally had to intervene in her own creation.
Yeah. By 1988, Mitzi Shore had clearly had enough. She cleaned house, literally and figuratively, kicked everybody out.
And then what happened to the house?
And then, in a move that speaks volumes about the intensity of the environment she'd fostered there for nearly a decade, she actually transformed the house into a sober living facility, a recovery house for comics.
Wow. From party house to recovery house.
Quite the turnaround. She eventually sold the property by the late 1990s, but Crest Hill House remains just one of the most legendary, high-risk, high-reward comedy incubation sites in American history. Just mythic.
Yeah.
And, you know, the structure and the influence that Mitzi built at the store, it continued long after the strike was settled and the Crest Hill House was cleaned out. For many years, the Comedy Store served as the official host location for the annual HBO Young Comedian Specials.
Right. Which was huge. That meant getting significant stage time at the Comedy Store wasn't just about impressing agents or managers who happened to be in the room that night.
No, it was much bigger.
It was basically the national confirmation broadcast on HBO that you were officially next. Mm. It really solidified the club's role as the primary arbiter of taste and the main gatekeeper to mainstream national success for a whole generation.
And this brings us back, in a way, to Mitzi's original, maybe self-serving, argument about the value of exposure.
Yeah.
While the comics absolutely deserve to be paid for their labor, the specific stage time Mitzi provided, especially once those HBO specials were involved, actually did translate directly into national television deals, movie roles, arena tours for many. She really understood the power of the platform she controlled, even if she initially distorted the economics of it.
And Mitzi didn't just limit the Comedy Store brand to that one iconic building on Sunset, did she? She attempted to replicate the model elsewhere.
That's right. She successfully expanded the Comedy Store brand over the years. She opened other venues in Westwood, La Jolla down near San Diego, Universal City at the City Walk, and even had a Vegas outpost for a while, notably at the Dunes Hotel. It really helped establish the brand's national presence and reputation.
And the institution, kind of remarkably, continues to operate today, doesn't it? Which really demonstrates the strength of the foundation that Sammy and then Mitzi built.
It does. The main club on Sunset is still very much operational, though the ownership has transitioned now to the next generation. Peter H. Shore, who is Mitzi and Sammy's son, is the current owner. He serves as the trustee of the Mitzi S. Shore Trust.
So it's still a family business, maybe the only family business in America built primarily on competitive insults and neurotic observations.
Huh. Probably true. It's quite a legacy to inherit.
And just to conclude their personal stories, Mitzi Shore passed away on April 11th, 2018. She was 87 years old in West Hollywood. The sources mentioned she was suffering from Parkinson's disease and also an undisclosed neurological disorder.
Yeah. And Sammy Shore, her ex-husband and the club's co-founder, he passed away just over a year later on May 18, 2019. He was 92, living in Las Vegas, died of natural causes.
So the separation that happened in their careers back in 74 was clear, but their joint legacy really remains completely inseparable from the history of that club, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You can't tell the story of one without the other, ultimately.
And their story, Mitzi's story in particular, is so powerful, so iconic, that it has seeped directly into popular culture. It's kind of defined the modern myth of the struggling comedian and the powerful gatekeeper.
For sure. The character Goldie, played by Melissa Leo on the Showtime series I'm Dying Up Here, that character is famously very loosely based on Mitzi Shore.
Right. Captures that tough, sometimes seemingly cruel, but maybe ultimately necessary gatekeeper persona.
Yeah, the character really embodies that constant tension between art and commerce, passion and payment, that Mitzi represented so vividly.
And there's also the 2020 docuseries, which is excellent, also just titled The Comedy Store. It breaks down the club's really complex history beautifully, era by era, and significantly, it dedicates an entire episode specifically to that defining struggle we detailed. The episode is titled The Comedy Strike.
Yeah, it's essential viewing if you're interested in this history. And finally, just to show the complexity of the relationships forged there, we have the dedication from Joe Rogan.
Yeah.
Rogan, whose career was absolutely defined by his years performing at the Comedy Store, he dedicated his 2018 Netflix special Strange Times to Mitzi right after her death.
That's really telling.
It is. It feels like a perfect little microcosm of the relationship Mitzi seemed to have with so many of her comics. Intense conflict at times, maybe resentment, but ultimately this deep, lasting respect for the incredibly high standards she enforced and the unique environment she created. #tagoutro.
So what does all this history mean for you listening right now? We spent this time looking at this single location, a former glamorous nightclub turned comedy crucible, and explored how Mitzi Shore, driven by this potent mix of artistic rigor and, let's face it, shrewd economic efficiency, how she transformed it into the high-pressure make-or-break system that really catalyzed the careers of arguably every major American comic from the late 70s onward.
Yeah, and if we try to connect this to the bigger picture for you, Mitzi Shore really embodies the central paradox of the arts, doesn't she? She was the woman who initially stubbornly refused to pay comics, clinging to that belief that exposure alone was sufficient compensation.
Right.
Yet her exacting, unconventional, undeniably demanding system, combined with the vital institutional spaces she intentionally created, like the Billy Room for Women, Fat Tuesdays for Black Comics, that whole package is exactly what refined stand-up, professionalized it, and helped turn it into the massive, diverse, and highly marketable global industry it is today.
She was the ultimate gatekeeper. Her rules, however unfair they sometimes seemed, somehow ended up establishing the modern standards of comedic excellence. You really had to survive the Comedy Store system.
Yeah.
Whether that meant navigating the fraught politics of the strike, the unique intensity of the Belly Room, or just the sheer chaos of the Crest Hill House, you had to get through that to prove you were truly ready for the national stage.
It was a truly Darwinian proving ground for jokes.
Yeah. So this raises, I think, an important question for you to consider today. That core tension we saw between commerce and art represented so vividly by the 1979 strike. Isn't it still reflected in how comedy is consumed and maybe how it's paid for right now?
How so?
Well, think about it. Stand-ups today rely so heavily on streaming specials, on viral YouTube clips, on TikTok, on short-form content. Are today's digital platforms maybe the new exposure model, demanding constant free or low-paid content up front for the promise of maybe getting that big special down the line? Does it mirror Mitzi's initial philosophy in a new form?
That's a really interesting and slightly uncomfortable parallel to draw.
Yeah.
Worth thinking about.
And also, consider how those necessary institutional spaces that Mitzi created, the Belly Room, Fat Tuesdays, how they fundamentally shape what we find funny today, simply by providing dedicated platforms for voices and perspectives that the mainstream comedy world had previously ignored or marginalized.
It's a legacy built on glamour, grit, debt, genius, exploitation, and the relentless lifelong pursuit of the perfect, maybe eventually paid, joke.
A perfect deep dive into the often messy business of funny.
Couldn't have said it better.
Thanks for diving deep with us today. We'll see you next time.